Hello and welcome to the programme. Carl Linnaeus was one of the most influential scientists of his time. He devised a naming system for animals and plants that was so clear and simple that it's still being used to the present day. Whenever the Latin name of a plant or animal appears, the name of the person who first described it is also given. And most of the plants and animals from Europe, and many from elsewhere, were described by Carl Linnaeus. Such was his love of and curiosity for the natural world that at the age of 8, he was nicknamed the Little Botanist. In 2007, the 300th anniversary of his birth, Richard Collins and I embarked on a Linnaean pilgrimage that took us across Europe. But we began our journey just down the road from RTE in Harwood Park. The documentary was first broadcast on the 31st of December, 2007.
You fellas tell me if I'm doing this right.
That's fine, yeah.
On the 27th of November, 2007, Sweden's ambassador to Ireland, Slaus Jung Doyle, and the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Councillor Paddy Burke, planted three trees in Dublin's Herbert Park to mark the 300th anniversary of the birth of a great man of science.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and welcome you. This year, 2007, marks the 300th anniversary of the birth of Carl Linnaeus. And Carl Linnaeus, he's not anybody. He's actually one of the greatest Swedes around. And he was the enabler during his lifetime to devise the binary method of classifying plants, a system which we are still are using in the world. And he did so actually when he was in the mid-20s, so it's quite an achievement.
Across the city, in Moyle Park College in West Dublin, science teacher Terry Flanagan introduces his sixth-year biology students to the work of Linnaeus.
Now, lads, we want to move on to something new today. We've just finished the study of the cell, and today we want to move on to the organism. That's all of the cells joined together, making the individual. And one of the buzzwords we have in biology today is biodiversity. And biodiversity means variety of living things. And nobody knows for sure how many living things there are on Earth. Some people estimate there could be as many as 15 million different species here on Earth. And to understand this, we need to classify these different species into groups. And we refer to this as taxonomy. Taxonomy is the science of classification. And by far and away, the most important taxonomist is Carl Linnaeus. Carl Linnaeus was a Swedish botanist, and he devised a scheme where organisms were grouped together according to basic similarities. His scheme is sometimes referred to as the binomial system. In other words, it was a two-name system, and these names were in Latin. And if we take some examples, for instance, ourselves, the human, our species name, our correct name, is Homo sapiens, or wise man. And Homo, the first name, refers to the genus, whereas sapiens is the species name. And in other examples, we could think of maybe the frog, the common frog, or Rana temporaria, or the temporary frog, because they only saw frogs at certain times of the year and refer to them then just as being temporary.
I asked Terry to what extent Linnaeus features in the school curriculum today.
What I'd have to say, first of all, Richard, is that the biology course changed about 4 years ago. And on the old course, there was quite a lot of study of classification and of taxonomy and of the various different groups of plants and animals, which are no longer on the course, sadly. And because they're not on the course, we really don't study Linnaeus in the same detail. And what you heard with me there this morning in the classroom is really about all they would get in their 2 years of biology. Now, if you see here where we are walking around the school grounds and you see, for instance, that patch of Dioptris over there, that fern, we always kept that fern there. We always kept it looking as well as it is now because we would bring students out and we would do classification and the mosses that would be on behind the rocks over there behind it. So we could teach classification by bringing the students out here into the grounds. But sadly, the courses have changed, and no longer do we have our fucus, we don't have the spirogyra, we don't have the helminthes, we don't have any of those on the course anymore. The course has changed now, so we've moved more to biotechnology and genetic engineering and cloning. For instance, in the old course, cloning had one paragraph in the book. Now it's almost a full chapter on its own. So sadly, Linnaeus, he's dealt with just literally for one class. We talk a little bit about his life. We talk about where he lived. We don't mention anything about his classification systems. We don't talk really about how many plants and animals that he classified. We just really get across the idea of the binomial system, the idea that it was a Latin system, and that that every organism on Earth has its own specific name. So you and I are Homo sapiens. And when we see other little, like the magpie over there, pika pika. And once I get it across to the children, to the students, that pika pika means magpie, it means magpie in Ireland, it means magpie in England, it means magpie in Wales, in Scotland, in Germany, wherever we see a magpie, it's pika pika.
But what exactly is this binomial naming system which Linnaeus developed, and how important is it? Dr. Matthew Jebb is taxonomist with the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin.
What Carl Linnaeus did was to establish binomial nomenclature, which was something critical to the study of all animals and plants, because until we had a universal naming system, knowledge couldn't really be accrued in a useful way. And the permanence of names that we have today means that we're able to develop permanent knowledge, always affixed to a particular species name.
Now, before he came on the scene, what was naming like, or how was it conducted?
It was fairly bizarre. Every country in Europe, every botanist, every zoologist usually had their own system. So even botanists working here in Ireland used to devise their own plant names, which could be several words, usually in Latin. Latin was the universal language of scholarship in his day. So at the beginning of the 18th century, the naming of plants and animals was really up to the author of any book that was published about plants or animals.
So if I read your description, I might be working on the same plant and not know it was the same plant. Is that possible?
It certainly was. There was a problem there that different countries used different usages. It wasn't so much folk taxonomies. It wasn't the names of plants like sort of daisies and buttercups and so on out in the streets. These were scientific names, but they were based upon often a whole sentence of Latin words. So the description of a plant embodied its name, but they were lengthy and misused from one country to the next and one author to the next.
So now he reduced this to a Christian name and a surname type of thing.
In a sense, but the other way round, the surname first and then the given name afterwards.
But he wasn't the first to think of that, was he?
Not at all. No, it was a system that others had used, but in a very limited way. What Linnaeus did was to say, right, we are going to use this across the board, not only for plants and animals, but for rocks and illnesses, even diseases. He classified human diseases in a similar manner.
So you had the name for the group to which a particular plant or animal belonged, followed by a specific name for that individual member of the group.
So this is more identified. And he referred to these actually as trivial names. He used them only as sort of nicknames originally. So when he first came up with this notion, it wasn't the system he regarded as the true plant name. It was a shortcut name. And he needed this for when he was on a field trip and outing with people, he needed to the annotators to write down a plant or animal name quickly. They had these sort of nicknames for them, which we've since adopted as this wonderful binomial system.
Now, of course, they're always put in italics, and the genus name, the first one, always has a capital, and the one afterwards, the Christian name, if you like, the specific name, is lowercase.
Yes.
He wasn't responsible for these sort of conventions, was he?
No, every 9 years or so, all the botanists in the world meet up at a huge convention and we argue and discuss all the rules. And during those 9 year intervals, submissions are made as to how we might tweak and change all this sort of system. So we have a very detailed rule book which ensures that everybody is using the same methodology and approach.
Linnaeus shocked a lot of people with his choice of terminology. It was very carnal, wasn't it?
It was indeed. There were various genera that he selected names on for highly suggestive appearances of the flowers, such as Clitoria being one of the more famous ones, but also the mushroom Phallus impudicus. These were names that perhaps would make a young maiden blush, but it was important to him to make plant names accessible to people. So any appearance of a plant that would have a popular name, and often you'll find that folk taxonomies use fairly vulgar terms for plants in the wild. These were useful ways for people to readily remember them.
This interest in the female anatomy, particularly in the use of names, some people have claimed that he was fixated on sex. Is this a fair criticism of Linnaeus?
I suppose one of the main reasons that people would take that point of view is the extraordinary sexual system that he used for identifying plants. He had a system whereby, and he regarded this as totally artificial, he said if you take a flower, you just count the number of stamens, which represent the number of male parts in a flower, and you count the number of stigmas or carpels, which are the female part, where the seeds grow in the flower. And he simply assessed something. He'd say, right, this flower has got 20 men in bed with one woman. So he would refer to it in a fairly, again, suggestive manner, quite sort of licentious behaviour going on in an innocent, sweet little flower. And many critics of the time would have been, I suppose, great professors of botany, regarded this as a terrible vulgarisation of a science, which in many ways they liked to keep aloof from the common man.
Now, you mentioned lots of ladies with one man, but there are all kinds of combinations of stamens and pistils and things. Describe some of them for us.
Again, you would often have a plant with six anthers and three stamens, and that would be typical of lilies, irises, and so forth. Another case would be a buttercup, where you have many men and many women in one marriage. And this goes all the way through to systems where you might have three men to one woman. So these were very easy mathematical ways of deciding where your plant would sit in Linnaeus's great classification. And at the time, about 7,000 species of plant were known to him, and not just from Europe, but from throughout the world. He had disciples working for him globally, sending back totally new plants. And when he came upon the banana, for example, in a hothouse in Europe, he had no problem in fitting it into his system.
In order to understand what Linnaeus was really like, we have to travel back in time 300 years to Uppsala in Sweden, where Linnaeus spent most of his academic life.
My name is Carl von Linné, and it's a great honor for you to meet me.
I realize that, do I call you professor or do I call you doctor? Or I can't call you Carl, can I?
Oh, you can call me Carl.
Hans Odo is an actor who lives in Uppsala. For many years, Hans has been impersonating Linnaeus, dressing and speaking as he did, to such an extent that he's become almost a reincarnation.
I was born in Småland, it's a province in the south. My father was a Lutheran minister, and he was absolutely fascinated by flowers. So he even decorated my cradle with flowers. And when I saw the flowers, I was smiling. One day he forgot the flowers, and I was crying. So that was the starting point, already in the cradle.
Well, you were born in the spring, your mother says, and that therefore you were bound to become a naturalist and be devoted to flowers because they were growing just as you were. Is this true?
It was in the month of May, yes.
Well, now, in those days, the parish priest, as we would call him in Ireland, was the sort of, he was the rock on which the whole community was founded. So your father would have been a very important person, would he not?
He was very important, and people came from far away to get advice on both gardening and also on medical plants.
So he kept a garden for that purpose?
Yes.
So the garden would have medical plants in it, and it would have vegetables, I suppose?
And also just flowers for their beauty.
Wasn't that unusual for the time?
It was very unusual. It was something that belonged to castles and mansions, but this was a small house in the deep forests of Småland, and it was unusual that a person like a Lutheran minister would have a garden like that.
So you learned your botany really from your father. Then you went to school, and you went to a town which is spelled Växjö, but pronounce it for me.
Växjö.
Växjö, I'll never get that right. But you went there to school. Yes. Tell me a bit about that.
The idea was that I would become a Lutheran minister just as my father. And therefore a lot of the subjects was about theology, and but I was not very interested. My fascination for nature had grown so much, so I left school without permission if there was an interesting flower in the forests. And the teachers, they didn't like this. And of course, I was one of the students that on Saturdays had to go outside Växjö to cut down small birch trees, and then the teachers would punish us with those birch trees. And actually, they would whip us.
Oh my God.
Terrible. And Sweden is a fantastic country because statistics has been kept. So we know that roughly 3,000 birch trees every year was used to whip the students.
Oh my God. You must have marks on you still from that, have you?
Yes.
Well, that's terrible. Now, in your biography, you say two things about your childhood. One, you give the impression that it was a very impoverished childhood and that you rose up against great odds to become a great man. And you also say that you weren't good at school. Is this true?
Well, because my interest was so much in the field of botany and in sciences, that was not the usual thing in the school in those days. So it was only actually the teacher of science that really liked me and saw that I had a talent for this.
So you didn't want to be a priest?
No.
And your parents were very upset when you didn't go forward for the priesthood.
Yes.
But that was your choice, really.
It was.
It wasn't that you were stupid or backward.
No. But the fact is that when I left for the University of Lund to study medicine, my father, he was very upset. My mother was, she was crying when I left to study medicine. So my younger brother, Samuel, they told him, you are not allowed to study nature. You should not be out in the nature because we don't want you to have the same terrible situation as your older brother.
Were you very poor? Is yours a rags to riches story, as they say?
I wouldn't say really poor, poor, but for example, my father couldn't supply me with enough money. So when I came later on to Uppsala to study here, sometimes I even starved because I didn't have enough money.
So you moved from Lund after a year, which was a newish university, to the older University of Uppsala, the oldest, I think, in Scandinavia.
Yes.
So you went to the prestige Uppsala University for your final medical studies, and you studied there, is that right?
Yes, but I was very disappointed with the situation here. In 1702, there had been a fire that destroyed so many things in this town. Among them, most of the things that Olof Rudbeck, the elder and the younger, the two professors, had collected, and their manuscripts and everything had been destroyed, including the botanical garden. At that time, when I arrived, there was about 400 students studying here. 10 out of those 400 studied medicine. It was a neglected subject, and the garden here had only 50 or 60 species from having thousands of species before. And I was about to give up. It was impossible to receive any grants. But then one day I met Olof Celsius, and that is the day everything changed.
Was he related to Anders Celsius?
Yes, he was the uncle of Anders Celsius.
And you knew Anders Celsius as well, did you?
Yes, yes. Very good friends. And when he put zero at the boiling point of water and 100 at the freezing point and then died with a body temperature of 63 degrees, I decided this is no good. So I asked for a new thermometer, and that is the one we are using today.
So you turned it round.
Yes.
Now, you studied malaria as your specialist subject here.
Yes, we call it the Uppsala fever. And I thought it was some kind of connection to the mud. And I wrote those theses, and I had to go to Holland.
Why?
Because in those days, you couldn't become a doctor. You could study medicine, but you couldn't become a doctor in Sweden. And I went to the town of Harderwijk. As I told you before, I didn't have much money, and Harderwijk was nearby. And there was a good song about Harderwijk, very promising song. Harderwijk is the town where they are selling blueberries, smoked fish, and doctor degrees. So after 1 week, I became a doctor.
So you bribed the professors in Hardevik to give you a doctor?
That was the normal procedure.
I'm standing in the shade of a magnificent ginkgo tree in the centre of Hardervik, a Hanseatic port of the old Zeder Zee. The tree is situated in the Hortus Botanicus, the botanic gardens on what was once the site of a famous university abolished by Napoleon in 1802. In the distance, the bells of the Grote Kirk, the big church. And in front of me, the Linnaeus Tower, with its bust of the father of taxonomy, Carolus Linnaeus. Local tradition links the ginkgo to Linnaeus, and Linnaeus links Hardervik to the world.
There are people who say that Linnaeus has planted the ginkgo biloba. But we have asked a specialist, and he says that can't be true, because the tree has an age of 200 years, and Linnaeus was here more than 250 years ago. So it can't be planted by Linnaeus. But the right way, nobody knows.
The ginkgo biloba is one of the world's most remarkable trees. A living fossil from eastern China, it has no close relatives. Whether or not Linnaeus planted this particular specimen is academic. He was there to get his degree. Walter Lodewijk is director of the City Museum in Hardervik.
Linnaeus came here in 1735. He had planned to come to Hardervik because in that time there was a very important botanicus, David de Gorter. He was a teacher of the University of Hardervik, and he was very famous in that time already. There were more than 15 Swedish students who they were even so gone to Hardervik to have their promotion at the University of Hardervik. David de Gorter was very famous. Linnaeus wanted to promote by David de Gorter even so. So he went by boat, came to Amsterdam, came in a second boat from Amsterdam to Hardervik, and he came to David de Gorter to give his dissertation. He gave his dissertation to David de Gorter, and he has his promotion.
Now, how long was he here before he got the doctorate? I heard he was only here a week or something, and he got the doctorate. Is that true?
Only for 5-6 days. In that time, that was possible, because Hardervik has even so a special printing shop, and they were specialized in printing dissertations. So in 2 days, if you come to the university and you gave your dissertation to the printer, then in 2 days they realized a nice version of the dissertation to give that to the university.
But why couldn't Linnaeus get his doctorate at home? Ulrika Gerhards of the Swedish Embassy in The Hague explains.
In those days, it wasn't possible to get a doctor's degree in Sweden. You had to travel abroad. And one of the teachers that Linnaeus had had at his grammar school, he got his doctor's degree in Hardervik. And I think that's probably why Linnaeus went to Hardervik. He had heard about the place. I think about 15 different Swedish people before Linnaeus got their degree in Hardervik.
This seems a very strange thing, that a country like Sweden, very advanced in so many ways, would not be able to create its own doctors. Can you explain how that extraordinary circumstance comes about?
No, I think in those days, the universities, both in Lund and Uppsala, they were fairly young, fairly new. They were about 100 years, 125 years old. Medicine was still not really seen as a proper education in that sense. It was still something where people were not sure if it was proper, was still seen with lots of skepticism. And I think that in the Netherlands, they were more open to the study in medicine. And actually, Linnaeus was mainly interested in the botanic parts and plants and stuff. And that was not a subject at all in Sweden. You could not study plants or the subject ecology or those kind of things. It was not available.
Yes, I begin to understand now from what you say why Linnaeus' parents were so upset that he didn't qualify to become a minister of the church and he was only going to become a mere doctor. Now, back where I come from, you'd much prefer your children to become doctors than to become ministers. That's a very politically incorrect thing to say, but it's true. But that was why they got upset, was it?
Yeah, I believe so. And, you have to see it in the time you know, we're talking about the 1735, that's when he came to the Netherlands. In those days, the religion, the church, was still a very powerful organization within the Swedish and still, yeah, in the whole European society. And that's why I think being a priest would be seen as the top notch of professions. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now he's come to Harderwijk and he gets his degree in 5 days. I believe he becomes a doctor in 5 days after greasing various people's palms, I suggest. But anyway, he got the doctorate. And he has a girl waiting for him at home whom he's going to marry, and he can only marry her when he gets his doctorate, because her father won't allow him to marry her unless he has his doctorate. But he doesn't go rushing back. He's a young man. And he waits 2 years. Why would he do a thing like that?
I think that he came to the Netherlands and he realized that this was the center for research within plants. I mean, nowhere in Sweden you could do any... And you couldn't do this type of research in Sweden. In London and Paris, they were also doing these things. But the Netherlands was fairly open to foreigners. I guess that has to do with the history of the Netherlands mm-hmm. as a trade country. And he was lucky to very quickly, I guess he was a very good networker mm-hmm. for his time, to get in contact with the right people and to have a chance to really get involved in what he loved, the study of plants.
So he was always very good at chatting up the right people. He was a very good people person, Arlenius, so it seems from what you hear. But now he is in Holland. He's a newly qualified medical practitioner. So he's spending 2 years now. How does he earn his living? Does he get up in the morning and start seeing patients? And if he does, he can't speak Dutch. I mean, how did he manage this?
Directly after Harderwijk, he continued to Amsterdam and to Leiden. And there he met the men of those days that were the men to know within the field. And via them, he got recommended to the very rich and wealthy banker Clifford, who had an estate outside Leiden in Hartekamp. And Clifford was a very eccentric man who had a lot of trade. And in his garden, he had his own zoo. So there were monkeys and tigers walking around. And they also had an enormously beautiful botanical garden. And he hired Linnaeus to take care of his health as a doctor. But on the side, he was also allowed to do research in his botanical garden. And that's what Linnaeus did for 2 years.
So he was a kind of a private physician.
Yeah.
That was an interesting role. Now, it's said that Linnaeus was the first person ever to grow bananas successfully in Europe, and that he did so in Holland. Is this true? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, at the Hartekamp place where he lived, they had greenhouses. And he decided to recreate the atmosphere where banana plants grow in and create a very moist environment. So every day he would come with a big can of water and he would water his plants so that they would feel that, oh, now it's monsoon time, now it's the rain season. And eventually he actually was able to cultivate bananas in the Netherlands. And
so he was a bit of an ecologist, an early ecologist, because I understood that they tried to raise bananas in the past, but they didn't think of trying to recreate the monsoon-type conditions in which bananas thrive. So he saw that the need to mimic the environment from which bananas came, and he did that successfully, did he?
Yeah, very much so. And I think at the time, people thought it was absolutely crazy, watering his plants several times a day and having servants helping him doing this. But apparently his greenhouse was one of the most beautiful greenhouses in the Netherlands at the time, with lots of exotic plants, not only banana trees, but also several other plants that had been imported from South America and Africa.
Well, now, bananas, he thought that the forbidden fruit of the Garden of Eden was not the apple, it was the banana, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And why he thought that, I don't know.
Oh, I couldn't think. Yeah. I couldn't think either why he would think such a thing.
After spending 2 years abroad, Linnaeus returned to his fiancée and the University of Uppsala. His most famous work would be the Systema Naturae, which ran through 12 editions in his lifetime.
In Systema Naturae, I classify the three forms of life according to me: animals, plants, and minerals. I know that today you believe that stones are stone dead, But during the 1700s, many scientists believed that stones have a primitive life energy. And I come from Småland, a district where every farmer knows that new stones are growing in the fields every year. When I classified the animals, I classified Homo sapiens as a mammal, which upset the French doctor de la Mettrie. So de la Mettrie, he said, Linnaeus put us humans together with cows and horses. I am not a horse. It might be so that Dr. Linnaeus is a horse, but I'm a man and I'm superior to the animals. Well, what did I say then? Well, I said nothing, because I never quarreled with other scientists. But Voltaire defended me now, and Voltaire said, Dr. Linnaeus, a horse, how fascinating. But then you have to admit, he is the number one among horses. And when I classified the plants, I classified them from the number of sexual parts within the flowers. And many people thought this was excellent, but not the German botanist Sigisbeck. Sigisbeck said, Linnaeus from Sweden will destroy our youth with his absurd ideas about the sex life of plants. And who could believe such a thing that the innocent flowers created by God was living like prostitutes?
Now, you said you didn't quarrel, but I think you named unattractive plants after people you didn't like. So if you don't like me, you might name some awful thistle or some dreadful thing that lives in sewers or something like that.
Yeah.
Did you do that sort of thing?
Well, I have to admit that I named a plant after Sigisbeck, who criticized me. It's a Sigisbeckia orientalis. It's a very ugly-looking weed.
Oh dear. Another thing I want to ask you, the stones growing in the field, did you think the stones and minerals were sexual? There was male stones and female stones?
No.
You didn't?
No, I have this order. So I say that stones are living and growing. Plants are living, growing, and they have sex. Animals are living, growing, they have sex and feelings. I think that animals also have feelings.
Can I ask you a very personal question? Do you have sex on the brain? You named all kinds of plants after female private parts and male private parts. There's a clitoria order, there's a fornicata order, at least there was, and there's a vulva order and things like this. Had you some kind of problem sexually that you were always naming things after sex? Or are you going to strike me or name a bad plant after me or something?
The fact is that if it wasn't for this act, the sexual act, there would be no plants, no animals on this earth. And I say that if there was no sex within 100 years, all life on earth would be gone. It would only be the stones left. So why should we look down on this? Why should we be so nervous about sex? Sex is part of life.
Well, you came back to Uppsala and soon you became professor. You taught in Stockholm for a while, or you worked as a doctor in Stockholm for a while, and then you became professor here. Now, it's been said of you that you had a very good eye for people with influence and power, and that you were what's called a social climber. Did you always seek out the important people and ignore the ones that weren't so important?
They seeked out me.
You were the best.
Yes.
Well,
I wrote 5 autobiographies.
Yes, and you reviewed some of them yourself, is that right?
Not the autobiographies, but I wrote 72 books, and those I reviewed myself sometimes under a false name, of course.
False name.
And in one of those reviews, I congratulate the author. No, the 5 autobiographies, in one of them I point out 19 subjects where I'm the greatest on earth. There's never been a greater botanist, there's never been a greater zoologist, and so on.
I think maybe you might also be a bit gullible. Do you know what that word means? Because, for instance, you wanted to catch a mermaid and examine the mermaid and put her into your Sistema Naturae. And you also believed in things like men with tails, Homo caudata, or caudatus, I think, you meant such a thing, and various. You really believed that what sailors told you in pubs when they came back from long voyages when they were drunk. You believed all this, and you still do.
I think that a scientist has to be very open-minded. And how can we know for sure if it's just something produced from alcohol and a great fantasy, or if there is some piece of truth in it? Maybe they exaggerate, but maybe there is something there. So I don't like to say, no, this does not exist.
And you were also, to some extent, the founder of a science which became ecology, mm-hmm. the interrelatedness of all organisms mm-hmm. to their environment. Is this so, that you see things in a kind of a systematic way that previous people didn't?
I do. For example, in my garden, I have three ponds that show the ecology of a lake and a river and a marsh. I also tell about how the plants and the animals interact. And as a matter of fact, I once said, I cannot understand how this earth could survive if even one of the species would disappear from its surface.
There's a scientist called Jean-Baptiste Lamarck in Paris who says that all animals and plants are changing, they're transforming, they are evolving. Are you at all sympathetic to the view that they might be changing like that?
I understood, finally, that there is change in nature. And I saw this change, but it was a very sensitive subject, topic in those days. But I wrote about it. But I had to be careful. And I have this idea that God created all the species, but gave them freedom.
Talking to Linnaeus, a.k.a. Hans Otto, one could easily get the impression that Linnaeus was a very arrogant man. Matthew Jebb does not entirely agree.
I think he was very self-opinionated, but I don't think he was a bore. One of the things we learn from history is how popular his field trips were, for example. So during his university days in Uppsala, 300 people would go out on a Sunday morning, and they would accompany him for hours in the countryside, looking at plants and animals and listening to him talk. And his method of teaching was very much in the manner of the ancient Greeks, peripatetic, walking along and discussing and looking at things. And he said, the most important thing is practical knowledge. You can write books and you can read books, but unless you have the flower in your hand and you pick it apart, he had very good eyesight, and he was able to hold up a flower. He hardly ever bothered to use a little hand lens, which us modern taxonomists are always using. He would use his own eyes and he would share that knowledge to other people. He said, look, see what you can see here. This is what knowledge is. It's sitting all around us. You've only got to look at it. So walking around to him was vital in this transference of knowledge. Although he was excellent at giving lectures, he would give long lectures without any notes. He preferred this methodology of literally strolling around a garden, picking flowers and discussing them with students around him. And the number of students who flocked to Uppsala from across Europe to become his disciples. He sent out some of his best students across the world. And these people were obviously imbued with his enthusiasm and spirit of the quest for knowledge. So I think he would have been phenomenal as a sort of charismatic person. He sent out disciples who transferred all this knowledge back to Europe in an amazing way.
Now, he believed in things like mermaids and the man with the tail, Homo caudatus or something like this, and various other strange things. Was he a sort of fuddy-duddy professor whose leg was pulled by the students all the time and believing all kinds of implausible things? Was he an absent-minded sort of... Did they lampoon him a bit, or is that a possibility?
Hard to say. Again, I doubt it very much. I think he was a man who didn't need to be modest because his achievements were all around him. And he would have spotted many a fake. I know for a fact that he was shown a hydra in his time, you know, a seven-headed monster, which he could see was clearly stitched together. And he dismissed this as complete nonsense early on. So he was obviously a difficult person to fool, and I suspect even if he did become a little absent-minded in his old age, he was still worshipped by his students.
Now, would you say he was particularly perceptive in seeing the essential feature of an animal and knowing to what others it belonged? Was he especially good at that? Did he have a special skill, a talent for that, do you think?
He definitely had this enormous talent for cataloguing things. He could just instantly see where things belonged. And what's very interesting with Species Plantarum, this great monographic work on all the plant species in the world. Occasionally, he puts a plant in the wrong order and class. And he's done that because he knows in his heart, actually, it belongs to this group. So he would even override his own system. He would be illogical as to how he placed things. Mm. So he knew the shortcomings of this artificial system.
It occurs to me that we have no real appreciation of what an extraordinary change that was. I believe that people classified animals on the basis of things like domestic, non-domestic, big, small, aquatic, non-aquatic, or pretty or ugly, and things of this kind. So we have no real sense of just how revolutionary was that for the 18th century.
In a way, we still can't even recognise it looking back, because unlike the study of botany, when Linnaeus arrived upon the scene, botany was not a subject that people did at home. It was not something that the amateur dabbled in. And then within a few years of his professorship at Uppsala, he changed all that. And in his lifetime, he had popularized botany across Europe. And that popularity was retained for a good century or so after his death. So suddenly botany was something that anybody could practice. And that way of democratizing science was, again, one of his sort of singular achievements in botany. Whereas in the zoological world, it was still something of a mystery. You needed to have a good background of anatomy and ecology and understanding of how do you classify this particular animal. It's always been a little bit out of, you know, the common man's reach, whereas botany, he was able to suddenly display it to everybody. And that achievement is truly fantastic, to have popularized a complicated science to anybody. Now, across Europe, many of the elderly professors were horrified at this young, cheeky upstart telling them how to reorganize their science. So very few of them accepted his notions or his ideas until he met them. And this traveling that Linnaeus undertook across Europe was absolutely vital in putting his message across. He was a man, obviously, of immense charm, and he was able, in meeting people, to win them over within a matter of days. So this sort of charisma he had is also a vital part of his sort of legacy. As a man in his mid-20s visiting an elderly professor at Oxford University, for example, he was able to persuade the entire system to be altered at Oxford. Every single flower bed was dug up and all the plants were replanted along the sexual system. So that gives you a scale of how somebody initially was treated with great scepticism, would win people over in a short order. That charm and charisma were vital to getting his message over.
Now, he was particularly successful in Britain, as you say. Now, why should the British take to him so well? Because those were times when they were in rivalry with the French and so forth, and this man from Sweden would be a very minor figure to them. Yet they were willing to convert, and the Linnaean Society's premises, their archive, is in London. So why was Linnaeus so successful in a British context?
I think one of the peculiarities of the British is certainly a sort of a modern wealth that goes back many centuries further than any other European nation. And they had time on their hands. They took to natural history many centuries ago as a great sort of healthy subject, a good outdoor topic for people to be undertaking of a weekend and so on. So natural history was almost in the nature of the British. And when they were presented with this simple system that simplified botany, they lapped it up. It became a central part of sort of Middle English life, if you like.
Can I ask you, how much of the great system that he devised, so we're here in the Botanic Gardens, this magnificent garden with tens of thousands of species, how many of them are classified today as they were by Linnaeus?
Well, intriguingly, absolutely nothing, but also everything. Everything still is named under a system devised by Linnaeus, this system of a genus and then a specific epithet. So we get the species name with two parts to it, two names. But we do not classify anything along that sexual system. We now use sort of insights of biology and evolution to recognize that constantly plants are changing. They alter their shapes of flowers to accept particular pollinators. They're altering their fruits to attract particular dispersers. So evolution has driven plants in diverse directions, but it means their flowers are highly modified, and many parts get lost through evolution. And in Linnaeus's system, the sexual system, this would mean closely related things are scattered all over the place. So we do not use his sexual system, but we certainly use his methodology of cataloguing and naming things.
Now, we've already touched on the subject of raising bananas by mimicking their ecology back home. And there is a kind of a dynamic streak in Linnaeus. Now, of course, he was what would today be called a creationist. God had immutably created all the creatures of the world, unchanged for all time. But surely towards the end of his life, the doctrine of transformism was around, with Lamarck in Paris and so forth, and Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. So to what extent would he have been sympathetic or leaning towards a Darwinian transformist view of living things?
When he started devising a natural scheme, a natural arrangement of plants away from his artificial system, he regarded 58 separate acts of creation, the 58 basal types of plants, which have then given rise. So he again, I suppose, used that cop-out of, yes, a little bit of creation, but then a little bit of change on the Earth's surface has diverged those 58 types into the thousands of plants we see around us. So I suppose he dodged the question very wisely in his old age as to how plants have become so numerous on the Earth's surface.
But you would think his private opinion was a certain scepticism towards orthodoxy?
Almost certainly, but in Linnaeus's day, as in Darwin's day, often this was not seen at odds with Christian creationism, the system of how all the species of plant and animals has reached its condition today did not depend on a single act of creation for every single species.
Strange as it might seem, Linnaeus' collection of specimens and almost all of his papers are in London. The archive is held at the headquarters of the Linnaean Society in Burlington House off Piccadilly. It is kept in an environmentally regulated vault, which Gina Douglas, librarian and archivist of the Society, assured me is atomic bomb-proof. Visiting the basement chamber was like entering a pharaoh's tomb. There is a mystical Ark of the Covenant feel to the place.
We're now down in the basement and we're going to go into the special store which holds all Linnaeus' collections. It's rather like a bank vault, so it's very secure, and it was designed in the late 60s, early 70s to withstand atomic blast. So it's actually, if the whole of the building was to collapse on top of it, this would still be here.
And what have you got in here that's so important that you're afraid atomic blasts might threaten it?
It's the starting point for all the naming of plants and animals, and this is really where everything began. It is the system that we still use, and it's the system that we will continue to use, even though we're now moving to DNA and molecular methods for identifying things. You still need to have that baseline to measure
things
from.
So his collection of specimens is inside this.
His collection of specimens is in here. His books, his manuscripts, and his letters are all in here, and they all go together. People often ask me, what is the most important? I say, well, none of it is individually important on its own, although obviously they do have that special status of being the types, the starting point. Everything has to work together. You have to look at the books and the letters to understand where the material is coming from. The specimens don't have big labels on that tell you where they were collected. A lot of it is interpretation.
Well, am I looking at an Elgin Marble situation here now? I mean, Linnaeus died in 1778, and in 1784, this huge archive, this marvellous resource, which belonged to Sweden, is carted off to London.
It was bought legitimately.
Oh, I'm sure it was perfectly legitimate, above board, I wouldn't suggest anything, but how did it come about, first of all, that the Swedes let it go?
Well, the king was away when, first of all, Linnaeus died, and his son eventually took over the collection. There was a bit of argument in the family about this, because Linnaeus at one time has specifically excluded his son from anything to do with it. But in the end, he persuaded his mother and sisters that it was deteriorating without that professional care and that he should take over it. But he died quite soon. And when he died, his mother had to remove all his collections from the house in Uppsala where he was professor. He'd taken over that from his father. It had to be moved within a time limit. And she had to realise some cash from it. She had daughters living with her, come back home, one still to be married. She needed the money. She'd been told it was valuable. And she wrote initially through an intermediary to Sir Joseph Banks, who'd been interested in buying it when her husband had died a few years previously. It happened that he'd already got too many other things on his plate. He'd come back from Cook's voyages. He was now very much involved in the Royal Society affairs. But that day there was a young man with him who came from Norwich and who had a medical training but hadn't started practicing yet. His father was a wealthy merchant and he was very interested in natural history. He'd set up a natural history society when he was a student in Edinburgh. And Sir Joseph Banks suggested to young James Edward Smith that he get his father to help him buy the collections. And that is essentially what happened. So let's open the door. We'll go inside.
Shall I kneel down? Shall I kiss the ground?
You don't have to. No, no. It's a working collection. This is what we always stress. It's not a closed collection. We have people coming from all over the world to see things here. Mm. And we're hoping that because of all the projects we're doing now, we'll have less visitors from all over the world because they're able to see things online. We're digitising most of the collection. We've got funding for part of that. We'll be trying to do the rest when the resources are available. So we're now going in to the library of an 18th century naturalist. You've gone back in time.
Yes, like entering the tomb of Tutankhamun or something like that.
Being shown an original copy of the Systema Naturae was especially thrilling for me.
This is one of the rarities of the collection and is one of the copies of the first edition of the Systema Naturae from 1735. This was published in Holland when Linnaeus was a young man, funded by Gronovius and Isaac Lawson. He didn't have money to pay for it himself. And you can see it's a huge, unwieldy folio size. So This was very unpractical.
Pages bigger than that of a tabloid newspaper. They're very
exactly
large. And this, of course, is one of the seminal works in biology.
The discipline was slow to get off the ground. Copernicus and Galileo had revolutionised cosmology, and Newton's Principia had transformed physics in 1683. With the publication of the Systema, botany and zoology had, at last, come of age. Linnaeus died in 1778 and was buried in Uppsala's magnificent Gothic cathedral. He had hoped that his gravestone would carry the inscription Princeps Botanicorum, Prince of Botanists. It doesn't, but perhaps it should.
There's a wonderful world of nature out there. Discover it on Mooney Goes Wild.
I see trees of green.
The rainforest.
The edge of the forest consisted of high trees with an evergreen canopy forming a green wall. But underneath this, I could see into the forest where it was quite dark and amazingly open. Not at all like the jungle ads you see on television for deodorant. And from here, it didn't seem to be raining. But when I got inside, oh boy.
The American alligator.
Now what we're going to do is take a very powerful flashlight, 500,000 candle power. And we're going to run along the shore here and in the marshes, and we're going to look for beautiful red eyes, those alligator eyes. And then what we're going to try is get up on them, and one of the students will hang off the front of the boat, and if the animal's anywhere from about 2.5 to 3 feet up to 5 feet, they'll hand grab it. So as we move up on it, they're going to lean over the front of the boat with one or two hands, and they're going to try and grab this thing right behind the head as fast as they can and yank it and pull it into the boat with us.
Do you ever lose any?
Students?
Yep.
Yeah, we've lost.
And the trumpeter swan.
That's a wonderful display. That's a water-treading display, but the male will do that with much more sound. You'll hear him. And you see him in threat. Now, look.
Oh, beautiful.
Isn't that lovely?
Isn't that gorgeous?
They create a smoke screen because we have snapping turtles here. Come on, Yo-Yo, come on out and visit us.
Just three of the documentaries available from the Mooney Goes Wild archive. For more, visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful...